We're driven by the search for better. But when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform with over 350 million global monthly visitors, according to Indeed data, and a matching engine that helps you find quality candidates fast. Ditch the busy work. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. Leveraging over 140 million qualifications and preferences every day, Indeed's matching engine is constantly learning from your preferences. So the more you use Indeed, the better it gets. Join more than 3.5 million businesses worldwide that use Indeed to hire great talent fast. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/Blue Wire. Just go to Indeed.com/Blue Wire right now and support our show by saying that you heard about Indeed on this podcast. That's Indeed.com/Blue Wire. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
Welcome to the RotoWire NBA podcast. It is Tuesday, July 6th. I'm thrilled to be joined by Alex Barutha for our usual Tuesday late afternoon taping. We are brought to you, as always, by WinBet. Check out winbet.com. Alex, Bobby Portis, only 250-1 to win Finals MVP right now.
You never know, man. If Giannis is out the whole time, I mean, Portis, 20-10 every night could happen.
According to the DraftKings Sportsbook, it is equally likely that Pat Connaughton, Torrey Craig, Bobby Portis, or PJ Tucker win Finals MVP, which I think seems about right.
I mean, out of those guys?
Realistically, which of those four, it would be obviously the weirdest Finals MVP ever. Which of those four could you, like, is there like a 1% of you could see some path to the Finals MVP?
Portis.
I think
Portis
so, too.
Actually put up 15-10.
Yeah. I mean, he could put up 22-8. We've already seen it. I mean, at least like with PJ Tucker, the argument is like he shuts down Devin Booker. You know, he like Devin Booker averages 12 points per game on 20% shooting for the series. And it's all because of PJ Tucker. I don't even know if PJ Tucker is going to guard Devin Booker all that much. We'll see. But yeah, I just wanted to start out with a discussion of which 250-1 player is most likely to win Finals MVP. Just, you know, kind of start with the meat and potatoes.
Yeah, of course.
Let's get to just Bucks Suns finals thoughts overall. As always, you know, the way that the schedule continues to play out, you know, we have to record an episode essentially due to contractual obligations during this time on Tuesdays. So, you know, we don't want to dive in and preview a game that's going to start in a couple hours. But, you know, the big news of the day, obviously, is that Giannis has gone from doubtful on the injury report as of Monday night to now questionable on the 12:30 injury report issued by the Milwaukee Bucks, you know, that every team is required to put out. So we didn't really get a true update on Giannis. You know, it's not like he came out and said, I'm feeling so much better, I'm questionable, or the Bucks even commented on it. It was just an official listing. And it could mean that Giannis is maybe on track to play tonight. It could mean that it's just a little bit of gamesmanship, make the Suns prepare for the possibility that he plays, and then, you know, shut him down. You know, it looks like he's going to be a game time call. But either way, I think if you're a Bucks supporter or a Bucks backer on the betting side of things, you have to feel pretty good about Giannis's chances, maybe not to play in game one, but to potentially play in game two. And I would think, you know, with the 2-day break between game two and game three is on Sunday night. You have to imagine he's back probably worst case scenario around the middle of this series. That's the way it feels to me right now.
Yeah, I think before game six, I think it was reported that Giannis had potential to get a green light for game seven of that Hawks series. Right. And so for me, that's like the big, that kind of set the tone for Giannis potentially being healthy enough to play if the Bucks really need him. You know, the question I think maybe if this was a game seven, he could go, but if you're Milwaukee, I mean, game one, I think favorites and game, I heard some stat that like home favorites this season or game one favorites in this playoffs are like 15-1 or something. But like, I'm not sure the Bucks would win this anyway, even if Giannis was completely healthy. Like, Phoenix has got 7 days of rest compared to the Bucks, like 2 or 3. It's just, I think if you're Milwaukee, you're probably okay with not playing him tonight, hoping he's good for game two. But for me, the target would be like game three, you know, at home. I think that's kind of your last chance to get him back and feel good about winning the series.
Right. And if that's the route that you're going to take, you're essentially saying we're okay with losing both games in Phoenix and sacrificing the chance, you know, to bring Giannis back at, say, 80% and maybe win one of those games. Maybe you still lose him and then he ends up not being 100% at any point in the series. But you're basically sacrificing potentially two games on the road to say we think we can win 4 out of the next 5 with a healthy Giannis. And, you know, the first two of those being at home. So it's a really complicated situation. You know, there's no real easy way to handle it. Mostly, more than anything, it comes down to, you know, if Giannis is going to play tonight, is he playing because he really feels great and he feels close to 100%? Or is he playing because he feels like he has to and, you know, he's going to be 75%? Because if that's the case, I view this series as essentially a 50-50 toss-up with a healthy Giannis. Like, I think I would maybe put the Bucks as a slight favorite if Giannis was 100% healthy, but it's pretty close. I mean, Phoenix has been, I think, the most consistent team throughout the entire playoffs, wire to wire. It's not like having Giannis back all of a sudden makes the Bucks this massive favorite. So all of a sudden, if you're saying that he's only going to be 70%, and, you know, a player like him who, you know, you can't just have him stand in the corner and draw the defense and be a decoy, you know, like the Nets were able to pretty successfully do with a hobbled James Harden. Like, Giannis basically needs to be 100% healthy to do the things that make him great. And I feel like Milwaukee could maybe end up hurting their chances to potentially, you know, get hot and steal one of these games in Phoenix if they're bringing Giannis back and trying too hard to reintegrate him.
Yeah, I mean, the Bucks, you know, I think the role players have found a completely new level of confidence without Giannis in the lineup. And I'm not sure that's like a result of like, I mean, it's just kind of like everyone has a step up mentality, right? Like, Bud had to change his coaching strategy. Every player individually had to do more. I think they found a good rhythm and good confidence. And if you bring Giannis back, that does potentially, before he's really ready, that could shake things up to the point where the offense becomes completely jumbled. Like, again, like you're saying, you know, Giannis at his best is an amazing help side defender, an amazing transition player, and someone who, you know, when his half court offense is going, it's going in a way it's a lot of spin moves. He's hesitating back and forth. He's doing these super quick drives to the basket. If he can't do any of that, I mean, his offense is completely limited to offensive rebounding, screen setting, maybe even a ton of off ball screens, maybe doing some Draymond type stuff at the top of the key. But that's not a way the Bucks have really played in any significant way before. And, you know, that could, again, like, it could cause more harm than good.
I think that's spot on. I think if he's spry enough that he can at least move around and, you know, like, I don't think this would be an Anthony Davis situation. Like, that was like comically bad. You know, it was like, yeah. How, like, this is like malpractice that he's even on the court. Like, I don't think it would get to that point with Giannis. But, you know, if he's physically able to do most of the things that he normally can, then he definitely helps the Bucks. You know, I think the Bucks have played really well these last two games without him. Middleton and Holiday have had two of their best games of the entire playoffs. So it's easy to kind of want to ride that wave, I think. But there's no case that the Bucks are a better team without Giannis. Nobody's suggesting that. He gives them, especially defensively, I think, some elements that they're lacking right now. But at the same time, I think if you're Milwaukee's core right now, you're feeling pretty confident, about as confident as you could. I think the one mistake they can't make is to, you know, assume that you can just pick up where you left off, because I think they're going to find out very quickly that Phoenix is just another step up, maybe even 2 steps up from the Atlanta Hawks, or even, you know, in some ways that Nets team that they faced in round two. I mean, this is going to be by far the most complete team that they faced. And the Bucks didn't play perfectly in games 5 or 6 against Atlanta, but more than anything, I just thought the Hawks were not able to make them pay for some of their mistakes and for some of what they lost with Giannis being out. I mean, it just felt like the Hawks were almost the team that, you know, that was without his best player in that game six. And obviously Trae Young didn't play well, but essentially they can't count on the opponent just not being that good and allowing them to finish out a series, because Phoenix is going to take advantage, you know, if Giannis doesn't play, and Milwaukee has to be ready to counter that. You know, I guess what percentage would you give, what percentage chance, I should say, would you give Milwaukee to win game one or game two? Let's say Giannis doesn't play in either of those games. What percent would you say, like, I think that they can come back to Milwaukee at least at 1-1?
Maybe like 25%. I think what you said about, you know, the Suns being a step up from the Hawks is something that I feel like is not being factored into a lot of the people's like conversations that I've heard regarding, especially just game one of this series. Like the Bucks, yeah, they looked great at points during the, you know, the final two games without Trey, without Giannis, but there were moments where the Hawks were ready to catch back up in that game six, and make things happen. And it's like, you go from that, to now, like you mentioned, a Suns team that is as much of a well-oiled machine, maybe the best well-oiled machine in the whole playoffs. I think you know, the line is, I think Suns minus six, kind of depending on where you're looking. It could shift depending on Giannis's availability, but I would be completely comfortable taking that. In our handicap in the NBA article, I just picked the money line because that's easier. But if you're someone who wants to bet this series, I mean, if you can find a line for like Suns minus 12 or something, you know, and get plus whatever odds on it, I don't think that's crazy either. Cause I think the Suns could come out and just like really punch the Bucks in the mouth here.
Yeah. I would say that's more likely to me than the Bucks keeping this really close and maybe not even winning, but like having it be like a 3-point game. Like I would say Suns comfortable victory is probably the most likely outcome for game one. And, you know, if you're the Bucks, that's in some ways that's like the worst case scenario. But at the in other ways, it's, you know, if you're Milwaukee, you're obviously believing in yourself, I guess, that you can win this game. But I think you have to take these two games as kind of a package and say, look, if we lose game one, it's not the end of the world. You know, we'd really like to win one of these games, but we don't have to win game one, especially, you know, with the theory that our best player is coming back and will be progressively healthier. If he doesn't play game one, there's a very good chance it would seem that he plays game two and is more effective than he would have been in a game one. So basically the Bucks just can't panic if they fall behind. I mean, things are positioned very well though for the Phoenix Suns. I mean, not only like getting here is one thing, like just the fact that they've made the finals is a massive victory for this team. I think compared to where they were certainly this time last year, even at the beginning of this season, or even at the All-Star break, it still would have seemed fairly far-fetched for the Suns to make the playoffs, despite the fact that they were basically one or two in the Western Conference for the entire regular season. There was kind of this just failure to believe in the Phoenix Suns. And a lot of that was just how good, you know, the Lakers and the Clippers are when they're fully healthy. Obviously both of those teams kind of fell apart in terms of injuries in the playoffs. But I mean, in some ways Phoenix is like kind of playing with house money through these first two games. But at the same time, you don't want to slip up and potentially lose one of these if Giannis doesn't play. I feel like that's, there is a lot on the line for Phoenix to not allow that to happen, if that makes sense.
Yeah, I mean, I the pressure is on them to some extent to not fumble here. I think, you know, one thing I think, you know, Milwaukee might come out in game one and just kind of throw a ton of different like experimental stuff at the Suns to see what works, you know, because I think during that Hawks series, they switched a ton once Giannis went down. Do they stick with that? Do they try to drop coverage? What kind of new offense can they think of? You know, because they've had a lot of time to kind of sit on this idea of Giannis not playing. So there is the potential that like they find something that clicks. That's, in my opinion, that's like the only way that the Suns drop a game within these first two, is the Bucks come out with something completely unexpected. It works and the Suns aren't able to adjust. But ultimately, like kind of what you're saying, like this is such a big opportunity for them. Chris Paul is this is the wrong kind of player you want to go up against for the Bucks, like the coach on the floor. Right. It's just like, because I think Chris Paul is going to be ahead of Budenholzer for its terms of like game plan. Yeah.
One thing I keep coming back to, you know, you mentioned, you know, what if the Bucks throw something at them that they're not prepared for? Like, what would that be? You know, I'm not trying to put you on the spot necessarily, but like what even adjustment do the Milwaukee Bucks have? You know, I don't know what that is. We talked last week about how many roster spots they're burning on guys who just aren't really playable, especially in an NBA Finals series. And, you know, you remove DiVincenzo from the equation, you remove Giannis from the equation, that just becomes even more salient. But, I think if you're in Milwaukee, you basically have to pray that you get one of those like 2014 Spurs Heat shooting games from your role players. I don't know that there's another path, I guess, other than, Phoenix having an off night and Holiday and Middleton kind of picking up where they left off in the last series. But like, I feel like to steal one of these in Phoenix, they need to have a game where they go like 16 of 42 from three or something like that.
Yeah, I think the only things the Bucks could do, like defensively, maybe they try some hard trapping, like trap Chris Paul the second he gets across the court, kind of like teams used to do with Harden. Offensively, it would probably just come down to trying new schemes and new plays that they like literally have not done all season. Like, I don't know if the Bucks have run like a Spain pick and roll all year with like the backside pick on the roller. Right. So it's stuff like that where it's like Phoenix would have no, like they could go through hours and hours of film. It would just be nothing they've seen from the Milwaukee Bucks. I think that's the only way the Bucks could like pull this out.
That would be a hell of a way for Bud to redeem himself. It's just like, get me to the finals. I've been saving all my good coaching for this series. And then he just pulls out like all these things that we've never seen.
Yeah. I mean, now's the time, man. And I think, the players are putting some pressure on him too to change things up. And I wouldn't be surprised again if the Bucks come out with something super aggressive to try to steal one. Maybe that is trapping on defense, but we'll see. I mean, I think this will be a really good game one, but I would still not. I still think Phoenix will win here.
I do too. I think that's the safe pick. I mean, it's kind of the boring pick, especially if Giannis doesn't play. That just becomes like such an obvious call. But I'm not gonna pick the Bucks just for the sake of being different. Especially when you're talking just game one compared to the entire series. I do want to talk finals MVP. I know we joked about Portis, semi-joked about Portis at the top, but Chris Paul is now the favorite at plus 160. You got Booker at plus 250, Giannis at 4-1, Middleton 5-1, Holiday 9-1, and then a pretty big gap before you get to some of the longer shots like DeAndre Ayton at 25-1, Mikal Bridges, Brooke Lopez at 100-1. It's essentially probably Chris Paul, Devin Booker, or Giannis to be. Like, if the Bucks win, it's hard for me to imagine that it's not because Giannis comes back and plays really well and leads them to that finals victory. Is there any case for, somewhat of like an Andre Iguodala type of finals MVP in this series where like Bobby Portis, that's a little too far-fetched, but I would imagine if we could roll back the clock and see what those odds were ahead of the 2015 finals, my guess is that Iguodala would have been in that like DeAndre Ayton 25-1 range.
Right. I think you might have to think of this one like, it's either LeBron wins MVP in those series or it's the guy who's guarding LeBron wins MVP. So if you kind of apply that, this is a little different, but if you apply it to the Chris Paul theory, it's like, okay, if Chris Paul's not going to win it at plus 160, the guy who's probably going to guard him most of the time is Jrue Holiday. And if Jrue Holiday can limit Chris Paul, limit his numbers, I don't know what that looks like in the playoffs, but let's say Chris Paul averages, like 15-7 on bad shooting, and Holiday can average, 19-9 or whatever. Basically, if Jrue Holiday puts up better numbers than Chris Paul, and the Suns, the Bucks win the series, also probably without Giannis. I mean, the thing is, can Giannis even win Finals MVP if he doesn't play the first two games of the series or whatever that is? So you kind of have to factor that in.
Yeah. It would totally depend on how the series goes. If they lose the first two without him and he comes back and they win four of the next five, then definitely yes. But if they were to somehow go up 2-0 without him and then he comes back, and even if he plays well, if they're up 2-0, that means Middleton and or Holiday have gone off in those two games. So yeah, it's kind of hard to track like how that would happen. But I still feel like Giannis at 4-1 is the rightful favorite if you're saying it's going to be a Bucks player.
I think you make that bet, or you're comfortable making that bet, the second that you see that he's available for game two. Then you can fire that off, I think, with some confidence. But other than that, I'm not sure. But yeah, I mean, if I had to pick one of those guys that you listed, I think Jrue Holiday is the best value, just because he has the potential to shut down the guy who everyone assumes is going to be the finals MVP. And then probably just, at that point, you're almost handed. If he just plays, well on offense, he should very much be in the conversation at 9-1.
Yeah, I like that approach, because he could basically have a similar or even slightly worse offensive series than Middleton, but the defense would be what really pushes him over the top. I think that makes a lot of sense. I mean, Chris Paul, there's not a ton of value at plus 160, but I am firmly entrenched in the, if the Suns win the finals, Chris Paul is getting finals MVP argument. Like Devin Booker, I feel like would have to like vastly outperform him for Paul to not get it. Like everybody wants, like this is Chris Paul's lifetime achievement finals MVP sitting there on a pedestal for him. And unless he just has like an off series or Devin Booker averages 37 a game on 55% shooting, like I just can't see the trophy being handed to anybody else.
You're 100% right about that. I think we may have had almost this exact same conversation about LeBron and Anthony Davis in the bubble last year.
Yes, exactly.
Where it was like, how much would Anthony Davis have to average? Like 30 and 15? And even then, it's like, I'm not sure that would do it. So it's you're exactly right. Booker would have to have one of the best NBA playoff finals series in league history, I think, to take this from Paul. Or Paul would have to just flop so unbelievably bad that, you know, you have no other choice. People still want to give it to him, though. Again, it's like how the gap would have to be so big in their play.
Yeah, I think the best way to phrase it is like it's Chris Paul's award to lose. Like he has to play his way out of finals MVP. He and the Suns, you know, I mean, they're in the driver's seat to begin this series. He's in the driver's seat for finals MVP. But yeah, very, very similar to the LeBron situation last year. And Davis played really well. Like there was a pretty big upswell around games like 3 and 4 for Anthony Davis to be the finals MVP. And I just kept telling people like, do not bet on this. Like this, he will not win it. Like it's LeBron's team. Like the league is contractually obligated to give this award to LeBron if the Lakers win.
Well, the thing was, you know, all he needed was one bad game and he was out of it. And I think that happened. I think he had like kind of one underwhelming game. And then as soon as that happened, everyone was like, nope, we're out. Yeah, I think it was game 4. Game 4, he had 6 points.
Yeah.
And played, you know, 19 minutes. But, or no, sorry, I'm misreading this. But you know what I mean. Like he completely fell out of it. It was the 15 pointer, sorry. Game 3 against Miami, he had 15 points and 5 rebounds. That completely killed his finals MVP chances.
Yeah.
Booker's in the same boat. He could come out and score 70 combined points in the first two games. If he puts up 15 in game 3, it's Chris Paul's. So maybe your best chance, I mean, maybe if you want value, wait until, you know, see if Booker can have 2 good games and then bet the Chris Paul number potentially.
Right. Yeah, I mean, there's a chance that could creep up a little bit. I do worry that if the Suns win game 1 and win game 2, you know, then obviously the Suns, you know, both Paul's and Booker's odds are adjusted for the likelihood that they're winning the series. If that makes sense, I mean, maybe that cancels out.
It does. Yeah, who knows?
We're driven by the search for better. But when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform with over 350 million global monthly visitors, according to Indeed data, and a matching engine that helps you find quality candidates fast. Ditch the busy work. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. Leveraging over 140 million qualifications and preferences every day, Indeed's matching engine is constantly learning from your preferences. So the more you use Indeed, the better it gets. Join more than 3.5 million businesses worldwide that use Indeed to hire great talent fast. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/BlueWire. Just go to Indeed.com/BlueWire right now and support our show by saying that you heard about Indeed on this podcast. That's Indeed.com/BlueWire. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
Philip has just lost the respect of the youth league football team he coaches. He was asked what New England should do in the draft, and his answer was objectively terrible. The Athletic just wrote a great article about this, but Philip doesn't have the Athletic or the respect of a boisterous group of 11-year-olds who once looked up to him. Learn from Philip's error, get the Athletic, and get the info you need to speak draft fluently.
One thing I want to ask again about is the Bucks shooting. Is there any belief for you that this team, which had been such a fantastic three-point shooting team for like the last 2.5 years, and it just hasn't been there in the playoffs. They had that huge explosive game against Miami. I don't remember if that was game 3 or I think it was game 4 to close it out, when I think they had like 10 threes in the first quarter. Like since then, they've had a couple stretches or, you know, quarters or halves, well, they'll shoot the ball really well, but they haven't put together like a great run of 3-point shooting. And it's pretty much unprecedented for a team that's shooting 31% from three to make it this far. And most of those teams are eliminated in round one. And if not round one, like for sure round two. Kevin Pelton on the Low Post the other day, or I think it was the Low Post on some pod, mentioned that the last team to shoot this badly from three is the 2004 Detroit Pistons, who were at like 28%. And that was when teams were taking like six threes a game. I mean, Milwaukee's just clanking a ton of threes, a ton of wide open threes. The Suns didn't shoot the three all that well against the Clippers. They were at 35% in that series, but they were on fire against both Denver and the Lakers. They're the better shooting team overall. Is there any chance that the Bucks can like catch lightning in a bottle and recapture that? Or do they have to kind of adjust to this new identity of a team that shoots a lot of threes, but just doesn't make that many?
I don't know, man. It's remarkable that they've made it to the finals with this being the case. I mean, they have the best 2-point percentage in the playoffs. I think that's important to note. But their true shooting percentage because of Giannis' free throws are still awful. I don't know, man. I think, you know, you just have to keep playing like that because, you know, if Giannis is out, it's ideal. Your best chance is to have a 5-out offense. Because the Bucks don't have like a quick twitch point guard that can like get into, you know, snake into the lane and still create good shots when there's someone else kind of packing the paint. And that was like, again, this is a different team example, but like the Clippers don't have one of those dynamic ball handlers really. And that's why Serge Ibaka was so important to them, is because he allowed them to go 5-out. And most NBA players who are decent at handling the ball can beat a guy isolation. So it's important for the Bucks to just continue playing like that. I mean, it's just as important if Giannis comes back because they have to space the floor for him. I think they're just kind of trapped into a roster construct of guys who will shoot threes, are average to above average at it. You just can't go away from it. You have to just keep taking them when they're open. You can try to do stuff like force it to Brook inside. Middleton loves those mid-range post-ups. You still got to shoot threes.
Yeah, I mean, obviously you have to keep shooting them. It's been tough to watch. I mean, I think you have to hope and pray that you get one of those Bryn Forbes games where he has, you know, he's 5 of 7 from three early in the third quarter, or Pat Connaughton heats up for you. Like that's kind of the way that I felt like the Clippers were able to hang around in that series. And even the way that they were able to close out the Jazz is just, you know, force feeding guys and just like, please keep launching threes. If you're open, just shoot it. And, you know, they had a game where they hit like 19. They were, you know, up over 15 made threes multiple times. Like guys like Luke Kennard, who were glued to the bench early on, you know, Marcus Morris, I think had like 5 threes in a game, maybe even more. I feel like those are like comparable players to the guys we're talking about for Milwaukee. You know, it's not Ray Allen and Kyle Korver who you need to get going. It's like these guys who, you know, are basically 35% free 3-point shooters because they're either going 5 of 7 or 0 of 3, and it all balances out. Like they need somebody to have one of those games, I think, to win game one or game two if Giannis isn't playing.
I mean, I've been clamoring for more Forbes the whole time. He's shooting 38% from three in these playoffs. You know, Porges isn't as good as he was in the regular season. That probably should have been expected, but yeah, I mean, that's another thing. You know, I think the Bucks can do offensively is just like, just run plays to try to get Bryn Forbes open and just have him shoot 6 threes, you know, because, you know, Connaughton's a standstill 3-point shooting guy, right? So is Middleton to some extent. I mean, he'll pull up, but the Bucks don't have those like run off a screen, JJ Redick types, Kyle Korver types. Like Forbes is the Bucks only guy that like really does that. So you got to try to get him good looks to get things off. The problem is, the Suns have great defensive personnel, right? I mean, they may not have someone who's great at covering Forbes when he does that, but I'm sure they'd be comfortable switching that. I'm a little worried about, like, this isn't 3-point specific, but just, like, Mikal Bridges on Khris Middleton, I'm kind of worried about that in terms of how good Khris is going to be able to play. So, you know, I mean, Suns got great defense, obviously. I mean, Suns and Bucks both have great defenses.
Yeah. I mean, for game one, especially, it's very easy to just kind of close your eyes and envision a scenario where, you know, Mikal Bridges like blocks a Khris Middleton pull up jumper attempt. And then, you know, the Suns run a fast break and he hits a three from the corner. And all of a sudden, you know, the lead is up to 15 and the Suns fans are going crazy. Like it just seems like we're headed toward that. at some point in game one, and whether the Bucks, I think, can kind of weather that storm and frankly not turtle up like they did in the second half of game four. And it's one thing, you know, to see Giannis go down and at that time think this guy may have torn his ACL. It's a lot easier said than done to just pick up where you left off. And you know, I think the Hawks immediately went on like a 12-0 run as soon as Giannis went out and the game was over. But, you know, being able to survive, you know, Phoenix, I feel like more than any other team has had those kind of moments over and over in the playoffs where when things are going well, you know, they tend to go really well. And guys like Jake Crowder just start hitting everything and all of a sudden the game's over. You know, being able to limit those type of opportunities is going to be huge. I want to look at the series correct score odds real quick before we finish out with some just kind of general playoff fantasy talk. Suns to win in five is the favorite outcome right now at 4-1. Suns to win in seven is actually pulled even, at 4-1 as well. Suns in six plus 450. Bucks in six at 5-1. Bucks in seven at plus 550. Then you have Suns sweep at 8-1. Bucks in five at 8-1. Bucks sweep is 16-1. Did you pick Bucks or Suns in six or Suns in seven in our staff picks article that went up today?
I did Suns in seven. That was just kind of fueled by like the uncertainty of Giannis. Like, I don't know if Giannis was healthy, I think I'd pick the Bucks in seven, but without knowing like how he's going to be ultimately, it's just like, I couldn't pick him. So I did seven because I think the Bucks can still make something happen. And I think maybe Giannis does come back, but I went Suns in seven. The Suns in five people and the Suns in seven people have just like the thing that's different between them, I think, is how healthy they think Giannis is going to be. Yeah. Like, I think, you know, the Suns in seven people think that Giannis might come back game two, be healthy, Bucks play competitive, et cetera. I think the Suns in five people think Giannis either doesn't come back or he comes back and plays badly. And I think they're just kind of assuming Bucks win like game three or game four at home. And then the rest of the series might be just kind of like Suns, you know, bowling them over.
Yeah, it's really hard to make an overall series pick when there's such a massive variable, not only for game one, but just, you know, the entire series. But everybody picked Suns. I think we had seven or eight guys on the panel. Everybody went Suns, I think, in six or seven. And I mean, to be fair, a lot of these picks came in before Giannis went from doubtful to questionable. I would guess if you told people that there's a decent chance Giannis plays in game one, maybe that would change some things. But I keep going back to, like I said at the top, even if Giannis is healthy, I wouldn't feel like super confident in the Bucks winning the series.
No. I mean, there'd be a good chance the Suns would win the series anyway. You know, we talk about like a team in Phoenix that they just, you know, again, the confidence level that you have in them, what they've shown to be able to do, they do not waver. They don't look nervous. They don't play nervous. I think a lot of that is just kind of they've taken on the personality of Chris Paul. And the Bucks are almost the opposite. It feels like they're going to waver at any moment. You know, just like it feels like they've kind of gotten lucky two series in a row with injuries. So, I think there would have been a good case for the Suns either way. But with Giannis being less than 100%, I think it's pretty easy for people to just, you know, hop on Suns no matter how many games.
So to finish out, I want to talk about some of the players who have either played well or played poorly throughout these playoffs, not just in these last couple rounds, but, you know, taking into account everything and how that maybe has impacted their fantasy value as we start to look ahead to the 21-22 season. I have our early top 150 up right now. We published that on June 8th, so almost a full month ago. I don't think we would make any like massive tweaks. You know, to me, it's hard to come up with one player who I just feel like 100% different about. Maybe other than Reggie Jackson, I guess. I feel like he now probably has to be shoehorned into this top 150 somewhere. But we also don't know where he's going to be playing next year, and obviously that'll have a major impact. But you know, even if we're only talking like 5 or 10 spots, like, would you move Trae Young up at all? Like, would you move up Donovan Mitchell, who was scoring the ball like crazy before he got hurt? You know, do you downgrade someone like Gobert, who struggled but has always been great in the regular season? Like, has anybody really changed their opinion for you?
Those three guys specifically, not really, because ever since, I guess, second half of his rookie year, I've been like a Trae Young believer. You know, I think, I mean, the rest of the team around him is pretty good. So there's always the argument that like his usage honestly like declines a little bit. I don't know, man. I'm a Trae Young believer. Donovan Mitchell, I mean, we saw the same thing from Donovan Mitchell last year, right? Like, he had an insane playoff series against the Nuggets in the bubble and then went and continued to, he had a normal regular season again this season. And as far as Gobert goes, like, teams in the regular season just do not try that hard to, like, play Gobert off the floor or anything like that just because it's regular season basketball. And he's someone, like, you're comfortably getting, you know, like, 15 and, like, you can almost pencil him in for, like, multiple 15 and 15 games with, like, mm-hmm. 3-4 blocks. Like, he's the prototypical, like, standard top-tier fantasy center. Points, rebounds, efficiency, blocks.
I would say I feel slightly better about Kevin Durant, who he had at 3. And to me, that was more about his per-game value and the hope that he plays more games next regular season. And he was fantastic, obviously, in the playoffs. Didn't miss any time there. Continues to look very healthy whenever he is on the floor. And, I mean, this is a little bit far-fetched, but the Nets, you know, bowing out in round 2, he's going to get more rest, I think, than most people expected. Then again, he's now going to play in the Olympics, which if you're a fantasy basketball guy or potentially even a Nets fan, that's not ideal just in terms of his workload. But I think Durant, you know, looked awesome, you know, playing basically every other day for those 2 rounds and playing a ton of minutes and not being restricted at all. I feel pretty good about his durability going forward. I mean, we had Damian Lillard at number 4 on our list. At that time, you know, there was not really any chatter that he wouldn't be playing for the Portland Trailblazers. That now seems like, you know, a much greater possibility, I guess, that he's not in Portland. Is there a potential that he lands somewhere else alongside, you know, another superstar? And we kind of have to do that same math that we were doing with, you know, James Harden to Brooklyn. Like, how does this affect him? How does this affect the other star that he's teaming up with?
Yeah, I think, you know, I don't think he gets traded somewhere and his fantasy value increases. That seems unlikely to impossible. So, yeah, we probably have to, you know, look back at previous cases if he ends up next to a player that's extremely high usage. But at the same time, like, it's also hard to imagine he goes to a team where he's not the number one option anymore. I don't know how many, like, unless you're pairing him with Jokic or something, because Lillard's a top 5 MVP candidate every year. So, It would just affect the other guy just as much. It's going to be tough, but yeah, he'll probably end up with a slight downgrade as a result.
Yeah, I'm looking through our top 10. I mean, obviously, if Giannis, if that knee, you know, it looks to be worse than it is now, or if he were to re-injure it, you know, we would have to have that conversation. I mean, Anthony Davis at 9, we kind of went back and forth on where to put him. I mean, he's a guy that, if you said he's going to play every single game next year, he would have a case to be the number one overall player. He's been in that conversation a number of times in the past, but I think we have him about right at number 9. If anything, that's maybe a little conservative, but he's missed a ton of time. He missed more time in the playoffs. He just kind of continues to have these weird injuries. Like, he's never really had, correct me if I'm wrong, like a serious injury, right? It's always things that keep him out for a couple weeks or a month or two. He's never torn his ACL. He's never torn his Achilles. It's just these like weird injuries that don't really even seem to be connected to each other. And, you know, they cropped up again in the playoffs. And I feel like going forward, he might just be out of the top 3 conversation indefinitely until he strings together like 2 or 3 years where he's not missing 15 plus games.
Well, and he really took a step back statistically as well this season. I mean, yeah, almost all of his stats across the board are down. Like, I think points, rebounds, assists, all the percentages. The question is, like, is he, you know, are he and LeBron kind of just going to continue to take, like, a coasting mentality, you know, for the next upcoming regular seasons? Like, is Anthony Davis he's going to play 31 minutes a game. He's going to score 22, 8 rebounds, not trying that hard, let the role players try hard. Or is he going to, you know, or was this season a product of coming off of the bubble and he had to take it extra easy? And now with a real offseason this year, he'd be able to come in with, you know, kind of a full head of steam, re-energized and get back to his normal self, which is essentially 26 and 10. I don't really know how to answer that. And you're factoring in the injury. So he's about as risky of a player as you can take in the top 10.
Oh, no question. No question. And I think I'm going to approach him pretty conservatively. I targeted him in a couple of important leagues this year that did not work out whatsoever. And I think a lot of people will. So, you know, the flip side is maybe you're getting him at a discount. And if next season he does, you know, miraculously stay healthy and comes back a little more motivated and looks like he's actually trying, then you're going to get him at a nice discount. But I feel like it's to me, it's like a 70-30 at this point, with a 30% being, you know, the positive outcome. If you're a fantasy player, I mean, Kawhi at 11, I'm still convinced he has a torn ACL. I have no information on this, but it's just weird. And I still go back to that Champs tweet, you know, ACL injury. That's almost always a torn ACL with Kawhi, with Clippers. Who knows if we'll ever get a straight answer. I mean, the one benefit for Kawhi to the Clippers losing that series is he doesn't have to talk to the media anymore. So I have no idea what to expect there. I still feel like in the back of my mind, there's a chance that he might not be ready to start next season, but we'll see. At some point, information is going to come out there. Let's see. I mean, we have Paul George at 19. I wouldn't put him up too much higher, but I feel like despite the Clippers losing that series to Phoenix and Paul George missing two, you know, very publicly bad free throws, I still feel like it was overall a net positive for him these playoffs.
I think so. And I mean, you know, if you are someone who assumes Kawhi Leonard's going to miss time, if you view him as a significant injury risk, I think you automatically have to bump up Paul George in your rankings.
Right.
You know, like if you're downgrading Kawhi Leonard, you have to upgrade Paul George, because in those games Kawhi is going to miss, George is going to, you know, play at MVP usage and put up, you know, elite fantasy numbers. So I think, you know, I think drafting him there makes sense. He's been relatively consistent throughout the regular season. He can, you know, in terms of like on a game-to-game basis, he can fluctuate. But over the course of a whole season, yeah, I mean, he's fine.
So we have Michael Porter Jr. at 23. I think I would maybe bump him down a little bit. I mean, he had those back issues at the end of the season that kind of reminds everybody, like, oh, yeah, this guy's a massive injury risk. That's in the back of my mind. And he also, I mean, the back, I think, was a big part of it. But he also just didn't play all that well, didn't shoot the ball that well. I mean, us putting him up at 23 was basically 100% based on how he played after Jamal Murray went down in the regular season, which was fantastic. He was a top 20 player, super efficient, basically the best version that we've seen of Michael Porter Jr. And even though Murray is going to miss, I would say at the very least half of next season, probably more, probably closer to all of it. I feel like Michael Porter just showed that there's a very good chance, I would say, that he wouldn't live up to 23rd overall value. There's certainly a chance he could. There's a chance he could exceed it. That's the reason you would take him there. But I personally would probably try to snag him, you know, 5 to 10 picks later. I mean, later, obviously, if you could. But I don't know that he'll last that long. But I would rather take a more proven commodity at this point.
Yeah, he should see increased usage, right? Like, I think it's fair to expect him to score at least 20 a game since he scored 19 a game this year.
Yeah.
But the Jamal Murray usage with Murray out, it doesn't really directly funnel to Porter because they are such different players. Porter is not like a secondary run the offense guy. Like, he gets his offense through cuts and spot up threes, right? And then he can run in transition, decent offensive rebounder. But like, he's not going to be like handling the ball and running pick and roll with Jokic, I don't think, unless he really makes some strides in the offseason. So I agree with you. I think we have him ranked a little high right now, but I fully expect people to take him there, especially in best ball leagues, you know, where you can be a little more risky. But it's probably the top end of where you go.
How about Julius Randle? We slotted him in at 27th. He obviously finished quite a bit higher this past year, but a big part of that was not missing any time. He was terrible in the playoffs. I feel like you and I were kind of on the same page with him even before that first round series, that, you know, it's just going to be really hard for him to replicate what he did, especially durability wise, this past year. I feel even better about that now after how he played in round one. Not that that just erases everything that he did during the regular season, but it feels like maybe there's a little bit more of a blueprint to shutting him down. And there's also a chance that the Knicks roster is a little more talented around him next year, which would mean that he's not putting every single thing on his shoulders every single night.
Yeah, I wouldn't be surprised if he takes a slight regression, you know, possibly because, I mean, if the Knicks continue to stay competitive next year, I guess we don't really have a reason to think that they won't. You know, with Tibbs as the head coach, it was proven that running your offense that much for Julius Randle is not a long-term winning strategy in playoffs. So you have to wonder, does Tibbs go into the offseason thinking, well, obviously we want Julius Randle to kind of still be the hub of the team, but like, what else can we do? How can we take pressure off of him? Because, again, we're probably not going to get that far in the playoffs with him doing that. So, yes, numbers slightly down, but I still expect him to be the number one guy in the team. And I would still draft him relatively high, you know, assuming they don't add like a, you know, like a really, really nice number two piece or even a guy better than him somehow.
All right, we'll finish out with these two guys who are conveniently kind of in the same tier for us in these rankings. Ben Simmons at 47, DeAndre Ayton at 48.
Well, Ayton is going to get a huge bump because of these playoffs. Like, no question. I think he'll have a completely new level of confidence in himself. I think the organization has a new level of confidence in him. I wouldn't be surprised if next season they try to get the most out, like, see what he can really do. Like, can he shoot some threes? Maybe we'll give him more post touches, see what he can do there. I think next year will be, what do we really, really have in DeAndre Ayton? So I would expect a big year from him, huge bounce back season. As far as Ben Simmons goes, like, I mean, it feels like it's inevitable he gets traded. You know, that's kind of died down while the playoffs have been going on, but I think he's gone for the most part. That's kind of what we've been hearing, and I don't really know what that does for him, honestly. Like, I just have, he has proven, like, he's gotten better defensively, right? We've all acknowledged that he was Defensive Player of the Year candidate, but his offense has gotten so stagnant that it's very worrying. And if I'm a fantasy manager, I don't know. Like, obviously we all know the upside. It's just, even with the change of scenery, I would not feel confident taking him like a lot higher than, you know, like his best fantasy season up to this point.
If you're a Ben Simmons manager, let's say you have him in like a keeper league, do you want him to be traded or would you prefer that he stays in Philly? Like, what is better for his 21-22 fantasy value at this point?
I think I want him to be traded because if I have him in a dynasty league, I'm thinking like, this is the worst team for him. Worst possible scenario. He needs to get out of Dodge. Like, him and Joel Embiid don't really get along that well. Let's get him on a team, like, ideally somewhere like Houston or like just a tanking team in general, where they can build an offense around him and, you know, they can basically feed him triple doubles. And so I think I would want him very much to be traded if I was a dynasty manager.
I think that's right. I think in Philly, you at least, we kind of know what the floor is, I guess, at this point. It's like you would just say, like, well, he'll probably just do exactly what he's done the last 3 or 4 years here, and that's fine. But especially if you're holding, like, you know, if you're drafting him in the season-long league, then you know what to expect. You know, you're not going to overdraft him. You're not going to take him at 20 and predict that it's going to be this big breakout that just hasn't come. But, yeah, if you're holding him in a dynasty league, you know, you don't really have that benefit of, you know, determining, I guess, where you're taking the bite on that value. I think there is a possibility that if he does end up somewhere else, all these things that we think he can become and that pretty much everyone agrees, like, the guy's super talented. Like, I haven't seen anyone say, like, he's just not that good. Like, everyone's like, yeah, he's really good. It's just, you know, he's missing a very key component and he kind of needs his own team. It probably has to be a bad team because it's tough to build a very good team right now around a guy that has the shortcomings that he does. But yeah, man, if you were to somehow end up in like Orlando or Cleveland, like I would be significantly more optimistic about just his fantasy production for next year than I am, you know, where he is right now.
I'm completely with you. I mean, he could average, you know, I mean, I think if you got him on one of those tanking teams and just let him do his own thing, he could average like, you know, 17 and 10 or something like that. Like, I don't think that's out of the question, you know, 8 rebounds. No. Again, I think you try to get him into a role where he's just like, he's the man. So, you know, it will be tough. Like, if he doesn't get traded before your fantasy draft and it's a redraft league, it's kind of tough to say. But I think even the threat of him being traded will boost his fantasy value to the point where I think he'll get drafted kind of in between where people think maybe his upside is and where his floor is. Mm-hmm. But there will be some really aggressive fantasy managers that will draft him as if he is being traded. So that's something to take into account.
All right, man. Good stuff. glad we got to chat before this game one. Hopefully we see Giannis at some point in this series, I should say. Hopefully that's tonight in game one. We will find out. I assume he's going to be a game time call at this point. But great chatting with you, and we'll be back later in the week to recap.